Okay, any questions?
I have a question.
Sure.
And a comment about the in-ear units. That actually two of comments now that I think about it. One, I got some of the molded in-ears, and they wouldn't fit in my ears. And I went back to the guy, and he said that some people have soft inner ears, and the soft ones don't work, and so he made me some hard ones, and those have been great.
So the soft ones did not work?
Right. Huh. Yeah, they mushed up, and they came out easily.
And now, with the hard ones?
It's great.
No problem.
Yeah, so there's one size doesn't fit all.
It doesn't.
You should be checked
it
to
doesn't.
See which... It is.
And you see that in the head-related transfer functions, everyone's different. They're all different. You know, the geometry, everyone's ears is different, the bounce off the shoulder and the head, all of that is different.
Then I had a second question about the white played-back device, the iPod-type earbuds.
Yes.
Those don't fit in my ears at all. Do they fit in some people's ears correctly?
Yeah, that's the Konka size, this part. That varies in everybody. There is a company that makes a product that helps it grab better in the ear. I'll try and remember what it is. And you could fit them on top of the intra-ear units, and it grabs a little better for people that don't have such a great fit.
Yeah, the ones that they originally came out with, they had the foam covers on the outside. Those worked better for me because they would sit farther out of my ear. But the ones with the new ones now that don't have the foam in. When they go into my ear, it's like they're laying sideways, and my ear canal is off to the side. Because I can turn them, and all of a sudden, boom, the bass just, pow, comes right out good. But normally, they're just like, they're not, they have to be lying just right.
That goes to the point of proper seal for proper bass.
Yeah.
You don't have a seal, you have no bass. In those sort of headsets.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is there any distinction or realization that I know a lot of people wear their buds with the wires hanging down underneath the chin, but some of the ones that I've worn actually fit better if you go over the ears and meet the back in the middle of the back, and even some of the pictures I think was short, like the E2s, you have to wear them that way, otherwise they don't even fit.
Some of the pro products are that way. And again, fit is important, the mold, getting the mold right, and the fit, they drape over like that. Part of that may also be aesthetics if you're on stage or on screen, somewhere. But there are many of the pro products go like that behind the ear.
In the binaural 3D audio world, we had a meeting in like 1992 of Northwest Cyber Artists for 3D audio, and we were saying that in the future we'd all have little memory sticks that would have our HRTF built into them. So you just plug that into your little white box, and then your ear is simulated. On the in-ear canal, so it sounds like it's the full ear, it's natural to you. Is there any thought of going that direction, have you heard of that?
I would turn it over to someone else, but just make two comments that processing power is cheap now, and the recording has to be of the right type before you do that sort of processing. Hmm. Either dry, where you put anything on it you want, or a binaural, or a free field, where then you convolve your HRTF. Your custom one with the signal on the fly, which I suspect there's enough DSP horsepower around that's cheap enough to do that. What do you think?
I haven't heard anything about that pretty much since.
There is a standard HRTF, which is in Windows, in most of those small devices. Works for most people. For many, many complain. For example, I know for myself that I hear the sound somewhere like this. I have heard complaints that the sound is somewhere down. If you go and measure your own HRTF, everything is in place. That is not a quite painful procedure. Usually they stick as very small, tiny microphones almost to the eardrums. You sit on a chair, there is a semicircle of 16 speakers, and the computer rotates the chair in an echo chamber. That's it. And then you can get this on that USB term, but there are no standards yet. Okay. So it's not painful, it's easy to do, but not quite common.
And so eventually you can get into some sort of a phone booth and get your HRTF. You sit in there, it spins you around, you come out with your data.
It's absolutely possible.
Get your picture taken at the same time.
There you go. Maybe when you're getting your driver's license or something, you're sitting.
Yeah, maybe with the 3D imaging.
Yeah, and that's the thing.
That would be the simplest.
The 3D sound was really supposedly be big, because at the time virtual reality was a just on the verge of happening.
The false dawn.
We're in the false dawn.
Yeah, it will come.
Fascinating.
But it was too early.
There was like in the late 60s or so, they used to have all those, when the whacked out speakers started really happening big, there was this one, it was like a stereo setup that was like those egg-shaped chairs that you would actually sit in, and it was all surrounded with speakers. And a friend of mine actually made one of those out of one of these hanging rattan chairs you could get at Pier One, yeah. And he put all these car speakers stereos on. It was pretty hacked up. But it was really wild. When you sat in it, you got this really good stereo field because, you know, the speakers were physically all over the place, you know. I mean, I doubt if it was accurate, but it sure sounded cool. And it could be really loud in this little room you were in, you know.
And chemistry helped.
Yeah, it was really quite, you know, quite interesting.
Immersion.
But that was when Quadraphonic was coming out with all those Quadraphonic records and, you know, the three different ways of doing Quadraphonic.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Another brilliant industry move to have three non-competing Quadraphonic systems.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. Maybe Ambisonics or something like it will come back as the future, where you can capture the entire sound field with the right array of microphones.
Yeah.
When you talked about the history of the microphone of the headsets, you didn't mention anything about stuff that pilots use.
Oh, I touched on it briefly. Dave Clark has some. And in the pilots, in World War II, that was Bell Labs did the development during World War II for a lot of stuff in acoustics, sonar, and Harvard, MIT did stuff on radar. But the throat mics for aviation was Bell Labs, and the tooth mic for aviation was also Bell Labs. And actually, they designed a standard product for Army. It was ANB, Army, Navy, and British. They supplied the Allies with that in-air equipment for stuff like that.
Are they not considered audio because the desire is to keep the outside noise off and just do a narrow range?
Well, they are audio, but they're like a niche in telecom. The goal is just intelligibility. They were barely intelligible. Remember, in World War II, these were, you know, four-engine bombers with not a lot of air insulation because it's heavy. And to communicate in the aircraft, it was just the most basic things. It's not like you're going to have a conversation like this. Did work. The tooth mic worked also. And also in tanks, it's extremely noisy. That's all the other application for that. Yeah.
What about devices that connect up to 5.1 and try to simulate 5.1 through filtering and things like that?
Headsets?
Yeah, I think I've seen them where you plug in 5.1 and try to simulate
There's a couple companies that sell USB chipsets. They take the digital stream in off USB. C-Media is the most popular one in Asia where most of that stuff's built, where it has 5.1 and 7.1. The gaming market for headsets, gamers are generally really into what they're doing. So high-end laptops, high-end desktops, and high-end speaker stuff is sold in the gaming market. This company has a decent Xbox-branded multi-channel headset, but all of that's available. That is on the dessert tray of what you can get when you buy or design or build a headset in China. You pick the right component, and you assemble it together. Included in that is there's a C-Media chip and other vendors that have 5.1, 7.1 synthesized surround. So that's all available. Just a lot of people won't pay for it. Well, they might pay for two speakers with simulated, as opposed to actually discreetly having all these different speakers crammed in.
The simulated is what I was interested in.
Yes.
So how well they work and how you recommend them.
I'm not familiar enough with that. I will be soon, but I'm not now. Next year.
C-Media uses the standard HRTF.
Yeah.
Places five virtual speakers in this range. Mm-hmm. So it's a fixed set of filters. It works quite well, actually.
There you go. And that stuff's not expensive. That their silicon's not expensive at all. Yes, there was a hand somewhere. Yes.
I was wondering what your take was on this European Union regulation of headphones. It seems a little extreme to me. I mean, regulating firearms, I could almost understand, but headphones is just.
Yeah, you know, I have the standard on my laptop. It's there's a British standard and a British or French standard. It was called the French Acoustic Decree. I read a lot of standards for work. These are very poorly written. There's no There's no input level defined, but there is an output level, and it's not clear if you're allowed to go over. In the pro audio land, there's a lot of ways to control peaks for a variety of reasons, like blowing out your system. There are peak limiters that look a short time constant, and then there are more RMS limiters that look at, integrate over maybe 1 to 2 seconds. So some approach pulled from pro sound to allow going over 100 dB for a short time for a dynamic sound, because that's what music is very high dynamic range, real music, or effects and gaming, stuff like that, wouldn't be a reasonable compromise. But the standard says 100 dB, but it doesn't say anything about how to get there. So there's a whole literature now around protecting against, what do they call it, acoustic... acoustic something or something bad, where it's from too loud sound. The way they're getting there is very poorly defined.
Yeah, I would think that in an iPod...
Acoustic shock, that's what they call it.
Oh. I was thinking like in an iPod, if you have a definite level set at your output, you have some level set, it could be very different perception-wise depending on your headphones or the headphones that you use, exactly how loud it would be.
Well, the MP3 players from Cupertino have a level now where you can turn the volume down. There's some limiting function in that you can dial in to, and that's really to protect the company from lawsuits, really. Who are we kidding here? But you can dial down the level, put a limit on the maximum volume in software if you want. I don't think that's going to protect them from lawsuits, by the way.
I actually thought it was because I have some really bad MP3s that have their levels open, way too high, so it'll go from a really quiet one to a really loud one with no warning.
Yeah, it's like a crappy FM station. If they're overly compressed, the signal-to-noise ratio on the dynamic range on crappy FM stations is like 3 dB. It's all compressed because that market, what do they care about? If you're the FM station, what do you care about? You don't care about fidelity, but what do you care about?
Your advertisers.
That's right. So how do you get the most advertisers? You get the most people. How do you get the most people? That circle of people that can hear a strong enough signal to keep your station on, you want that as big as possible. How do you do that? You crank the compression all the way up. And so you don't have real music, but your coverage is high. Your coverage area is high. So that's highly compressed products are... if you have a normal dynamic range and then you switch to a compressed one, then you're going to get that effect. In video Dolby has a switch in their spit stream to regulate the level so that you have a compressed commercial, your level won't go through the roof. If you're watching a movie that's wideband, that's high dynamic range, you get a commercial that's very compressed. There is some Dolby control on that to prevent it from going too high. Actually, that's within a movie, so that you can turn compression on when you're watching at night. I think that was the real use for it. So if you're watching at 2 a.m., it doesn't get out of control. Doesn't wake the baby. Because you want compression then to keep its range relatively low. Does that answer your question?
I didn't really ask one, so yeah.
Oh, okay, good. That was easy.
It addresses the comment.
Yeah. Anybody,
I was going back yes. to the standard. It seems like the in-ear... headphones are used as in-ear monitors by some musicians because they've already blown their hearing, but they still want to play. So it seemed like 100 dB would not be enough to compensate for the hearing.
Oh, yeah. In pro land, I don't think they could ever reach that. I mean, who's going to enforce that? But, yeah, the musicians who have damaged their hearing, and also people who listen to the white MP3 player too long, they're going deaf. And so what you could do, a workaround, is go to a real audiologist that has good equipment and invert whatever damage you've got, you know, and turn with a programmable hearing aid, you can, a lot of soldiers lose the mid-band because they're too close to a rifle or an artillery piece, so they have a deep notch. After World War II, a lot of soldiers came back with a deep notch. You could invert that in an EQ and boost up where you've lost your hearing. So that's in future hearing aids. So the follow-on, as these people get older, they're going to need custom hearing aids to recover some of the loss. Up to a certain point, when it's profound hearing loss, it's too late. Does that answer your question? Okay.
The standard doesn't allow for that at all. It doesn't allow for...
For pro? Pro, I think, can do whatever they want. There's no way to enforce it. This is for consumer devices. Yeah, I have the standard on here. I'll show you. I mean, there's two standards. I have it because we were faced with the issue of how do you comply with it? Should we comply? If you do comply, what is the standard? It's very poorly written. Yeah.
Okay, question.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. Two things. The standard is not law. The standard is just that. It's a recommendation
a set of guidelines that you can choose to follow or you can choose to ignore. But the thing that really gets my curiosity here is how they expect to limit the SPL in an MP3 player unless they do it at the ear set.
Well, there's two standards. One is addressing the combination of a player and speakers. Then it is very possible, because you know the whole system, efficiency, sensitivity, how much power the player has. That's more realistic if they're sold as a set. But the second standard, I'll pull that up, is for loose headsets, which is now, that's so hard to control. Because, for example, normally you could separate telephony land from music land because the jacks are different sizes. And a cell phone, they're 2.5 millimeter. In audio, they're 3.5 millimeter. So there was a clear way to separate that until the company from Cupertino put a 3.5 millimeter jack on the iPhone. And so now you can't separate. So I'm gonna bring those standards up. So they're
my children lost on purpose the little white earbuds that came with their Cupertino audio players. And so now they're just buying, they buy headphones on the open market.
So it's hard to control. But what it really means, what it means is that they are setting American and foreign companies up for a big lawsuit sooner or later in Europe. Yeah, maybe we don't have to, but most companies sell everywhere and they're going to get sued and they're just going to rip off an American company. There needs to be a bona fide effort to control hearing damage. Whatever that mechanism is, I don't know. But they're trying to bring the hammer down on people that want to listen to music.
Just to insert, I'm just back from Europe. It's not standard trick. It's a regulation. It's something which United Europe is going to enforce. All products sold on the territory of European countries should not allow sound level above 100 dB.
It's like the Rojas standard. The
so there is law.
It is going to become a law very soon because I heard the campaign around this whole before the law to be discussed in the European Parliament.
Yeah, here it is. Yeah, IEC EN 50332 1 and 2. Let me see if I can get that on here. But yeah, they're going to take that seriously, so I'm not sure what to do about it. Well, I know what we did about it, but that's a separate conversation.
It's people under NDA,
We made a bona fide effort. Microsoft made a bona fide effort to comply with that, and we really did make the effort. However, we're not selling high-end music headphones where you want it to play loud on the peaks. The issue is, with dynamic material, a common-sense approach would allow some overage for short times because that's the way OSHA regulates it. It's an integrated amount of damage or exposure over a period of time, and so you could go briefly over and still get the dynamics but not stay over 100 dB for a long time. That is a workable solution, but I don't expect it of that standard.
To comply with that, wouldn't that mean the headphone would have to have a microprocessor in it? I mean...
No.
Or are you thinking
or
about
mechanical limitations?
Well, there's lots of ways to limit it. The simplest way, let's put it that way, the simplest way is to just make sure that the speakers aren't sensitive. And if they're too sensitive, you can degrade the sensitivity with an inline resistor.
But I meant the integration over time.
Oh, yes. Yeah. It is doable, but the flip side is also true. It leaves you open to litigation if you can prove I listened to white headset number serial number X over the course of a year, and I listened over 95 dB for 1,000 hours. Now you've got a proof that a supplier of this product, through that product, you damaged your ears. Look at it from a lawyer's point of view. If you have an intelligent user, you turn it off when you hit the limit. But all you're doing is leaving a record of, I listened to music too loud, unless it automatically shuts it down.
Yeah. But there's studies enough with, like, I remember reading a study about long-term truck drivers. And it was the thing was about ear sound damage, hearing damage done by not loud noise, but persistent sound of a particular frequency.
Sure.
Over a long period of time, actually breaking the cilia off in the cochlea.
Sure.
And that stuff, like, if you're in an office building with an air conditioner that's on all the time and you're there 8 hours a day and that same frequency is in your head all the time, you're going to lose hearing from that.
Yeah, the way you lose hearing is, pardon me, it's the integration over time of how much exposure you have. So there's two sets of trade-offs. There's a 5 dB rule and a 4 dB rule, but it's sort of 85 dB is the baseline for 8 hours. I think it's 80 or 85. And then each time you go up by 4 or 5 dB, the exposure time's cut in half. Mm-hmm. So you could still be exposed to 75 dB below the threshold, but if you're doing it driving a truck across the country, it takes about 48 hours to drive a truck coast to coast. If you stay up drinking caffeine, you've now still exceeded the dose. Do you know what I mean? Also, I believe it's a weighting, so if you're driving a truck, you're going to get a ton of low-frequency stuff that's not going to show up on an integrating, what do they call it, the dosimeter. That you could put the way you check that in industrial hygiene land, which I did one of those jobs, you have a worker wear a mic, and he walks around with a dosimeter. It keeps track of the dose over a shift, and then you download the data, and you see how loud was it, A-weighted, over that 8-hour shift. If you've got a ton of low-frequency noise over 48 hours, you're still probably going to have trouble, plus all the transients, also the very short-term ones. Even if they're really short, you can still get a lot of damage that way. So the U.S. government approach is not perfect. At least it's a bona fide effort to protect people in noisy environments.
Doesn't A-weighting disregard the low-frequency?
It does. That's the point, is that if all you're looking at is A-weighting and you've got a ton of low-frequency noise, you're still going to miss that. That is, you're still going to get the exposure, but the weighting, also the weighting assumes what's called a certain level, 40 phones level at 1K.
The weighting is exactly at 40 phones.
Right. So the hearing mechanism is nonlinear. So especially in the bass, as the bass exposure goes up and up, after a while, the filter you've got built into your body nonlinearly shuts off. So a small increase in sound power at 20 hertz at a given SPL has a very big difference because now it's unfiltered. And so you can do a lot of damage to yourself. I mean, what can I say? I mean, active noise cancellation might be a good idea for those guys as long as they can hear what's going on.
But that doesn't show up on their dosimeter?
Dosimeters, I think, are A-weighted only, and they're assuming a 40 phones level. Really loud industrial noise breaks that rule. But it is legalistically a bona fide approach to protect workers in the industrial hygiene land.
So there can still be damage that doesn't show up on the
dosimeter. Sure, but it's better than nothing because I did another job at a port where a lot of the stevedores, the guys who move the containers around off the ship onto the trucks or rail, they would work at Port of Oakland for 30 years or whatever. And then when they retired, they would put in a claim for loss of hearing because they're working on big forks or big vehicles that did damage their hearing. They just use it as they lost their hearing, but they knew that was going on. And at the end, they use it as a retirement bonus. So they'd sue the Steve Doring company, and they'd get, $100,000, and then they'd go away and retire. So that's a non-optimal solution. The best solution is to protect them from the get-go, because the company's interest then aligns with their interests, where it protects their hearing, protects them from lawsuits, and everybody's happy. Rather than gaming the system, which what is done, the Steve Doring, the whatever the dock workers union plays that game, and they get their money. Now, I was hired by the company to say, well, how do we protect our workers against it? And it wasn't out of the goodness of their heart. It's because they didn't want to write $100,000 checks anymore. And so so you could make them wear dosimeters or hearing protection. That's a reasonable solution, where it's a social good that compromise is struck. That your Europeans are way off. I think they're overly aggressive, perhaps, and there should be some more flexible. I have these standards here. I'm trying to figure out how to get them on the screen. But
it's probably okay.
Oh, okay. They're not exactly exciting. They're on sound system equipment, headphone and earphones associated with portable audio equipment, maximum sound pressure level measurement methodology, and limit considerations, part one, general method for one package equipment. The first standard is on headphones that ship with MP3 players.
Try dragging it across to the
screen.
Oh,
yeah, that's a good idea. I should do that. See if that'll work.
If you can get your cursor visible, which you can.
Oh, shit. No. All right. Yeah. All right.
Yeah, you did have your cursor over there. So.
I did?
Yeah.
Well, maybe it's the other way. Is it the other way? Oh, yeah, then I can do that. Okay.
Sneaky little
cursor.
Way to go. Okay, so that's the first standard. And then there's another one. So that you can make a case that packaged products, okay, the manufacturer controls everything. Yeah. And they can make a good faith effort to limit the sound with either peak limiting or RMS limiting. But the second standard, this is like a slippery slope. The second standard, where's my cursor? The second standard is way more open here. That this is the second standard. This is matching sets of headphones if either or both are offered separately. So that means you could have a separate headset that you attach to some unknown MP3 player or whatever. Now, how do you... that's really hard. That means it has to be... Who said that? You could put it in the headset so that if it interrogates integrates the voltage level and figures... It knows its sensitivity and it even knows the spectral content of what goes through. Yeah. You could protect yourself, but that's... Who's going to do that?
If C-Media...
Well, if C-Media integrated into a chip, maybe they could do that, actually. You could drive it through that angle, but...
Well, the other thing they could do is come up with yet another audio connector and have their own proprietary player and headphones.
Yeah, well, look what happened to... in Cupertino, there was a custom connector on the first iPhone, and that they chucked that out because people didn't like it. It was a long, extended four-conductor one, so you needed to buy adapters. So I don't know if an easy solution, but clearly this is coming, and probably coming to the U.S. also. Because a lot of people are going deaf.
They could use the connectors that they use on the remote headset, you know, the headphones for like the iPhone and stuff that have, it's the same size, the same eighth inch connector, but it does have four connectors. You know, four conductors. But then you're right, it has to be intelligent. You either have to have an intelligent adapter that went between any dumb set of headphones and your any dumb player that did the translations in line.
Well, there's hope if it's through a USB, if it's a digital input. There has to be some silicon, some intelligence, do the D to A for a USB headphone. So it could one day be built in there. Analog headphones, I think, is hopeless because there's too many variables.
It's the analog hole again.
Yes. Yeah, it's hopeless because there's too many plug-and-play variables. But a USB, then I think it's possible because each device has a unique PID, product identifier, number or something, and it could go to the internet, do a lookup table if necessary, to figure out where it should...
Like they think that you can make a mechanical limitation in the headphones.
Well, there is an analog way to do that. There is analog circuitry that can protect above a certain voltage level. You set that level, and then it resets later. It's like it throws the switch, it drops the level, then it recovers, and then lets voltage through again. But
is there a way to do it acoustically?
Acoustically? I mean, your ear has an acoustical mechanism that if you get a loud sound, the muscles contract, and the efficiency of that lever system that we saw is degraded for a while, but it's not fast enough for things that we're typically going to run into, like a car crash or a gunshot in a movie, which everyone's exposed to. Right. It's not quick enough. But there is a way the muscles pull back and those three little bones... Are partly disengaged to protect your ear. In the old days, I guess, when there were no home theaters, I guess that worked out in the wild or something. Here we are. USB digital way is, I think, the only way to do that.
That muscle also doesn't work for long term.
Oh,
it's only for short term.
Well, that's all you need it.
But if you're counting on it to give you some long term protection, it's not.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It's not going to be long term. Yeah.
That was something we looked at in this acoustics firm I worked for was the pilot tower communications, and our proposal was to look at long-term degradation of the hearing due to exposure to noise and the relaxing of that mechanism, and we tested it by trying to see if there was a degradation in intelligibility of the speech.
Was there?
We set our levels, I think, high enough so that the FAA liked us.
There's also some artillery pieces have a warning tone before they're ignited to discharge the shell, where it's loud enough to trigger that mechanism so that the guy will pull the cord or hit the button for the artillery piece to fire. But before the ignition, there's some noise mechanism that causes that temporary contraction of the muscles, and then that piece goes off. Then it's gone and it's over.
If it scares you and you drop it, this would be a bad thing.
Yeah, but, you know, I guess when you're busy pounding somebody with artillery, we got to protect everyone's
ears,
right?
For that. Except for the people you're firing on, they don't protect their ears.
No, that's not the point. But don't worry, they're probably bad people.
Ah, there you go.
Well, do you think that the bottom line here is whether or not they have a pretty good shot at enforceability? And if they do, how far are they going to take that? Are they going to say to the Berlin Philharmonic, guys, you can't play above 100 dB.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Here's the thing.
It does say associated here, with
but here's the thing that's interesting. Right? When they talk about dB levels, they're not talking about the guy sitting next to the trombone player or anything like that.
That's right.
The heck out there.
In the
and
orchestra,
we all know,
right.
Any of us who've ever played in a group, that if you're up close and personal, you're talking about extraordinarily high sound pressure levels and not just transients. It depends
that's
on
true.
What you're playing. It
in a
could
real,
go on and on.
In a real orchestra, the
and
levels are high.
And that's your work environment. You think they would do that to the Vienna Philharmonic?
No, I don't
sorry,
think
guys,
so.
You can't...
I don't think so.
It's possible they could outlaw the 1812 overture.
In Europe. Well, maybe the military can.
The point, though, is this is coming. In one, it'll probably make its way into a better written standard, IEEE standard, sooner or later, just to protect ourselves. But there's better ways to do it.
The same people who brought you Rojas.
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, I deal with that offshore, and at first I thought it was the European nanny state, you know, giving everyone a hard time. However, now that I've been to a lot of factories that attempt a ROS, the reduction of hazardous substances, there's the ROS 1, ROS 2, and then the follow-on is called REACH, reduction of some chemical substances.
Chemical.
I don't want to be in those factories either that have all this lead and stuff and mercury and arsenic, hexavalent chromium, and the worker is number one of the biggest beneficiaries. And number two, you think these factories in less developed countries care about what happens? It all go leaks into the water supply. I mean, I was at a factory.
But it's already there. I mean, this is the thing. It's just that it's one thing to protect workers. That makes sense. But to go and protect us all from the ability to use the stuff in some carefully controlled way. I mean, the whole transition from lead solder is a real disaster. I mean,
yeah, it is, actually.
It really is.
It is.
It really costs a lot of money.
It is.
It's, producing unreliable equipment. Now you have equipment that's bound to fail within a few years.
That's true. That is definitely true.
Enforced failure, and what they should enforce is the recycling of lead products, like computers and all this other stuff that's produced in such high volumes. That's the thing that needs to be done. Not control using it, it's control recycling it.
Well, it's a mixed bag because it is increasing failure. Circuit boards and assembly is much more complicated because non-lead solder has to be heated to a higher temperature.
Right.
So
because
everyone's calibrated to do it a certain way. Now that it goes up another 40 or 50 degrees, it's much more complicated.
Doesn't solder well.
However, there's also a copper draw from the circuit board. If you look at it over time, and there's also another mechanism over a decade that wrecks that joint.
Yep.
Medical electronics were excerpted and military were excerpted. They don't have to comply. Yep. And I suspect a lot of government stuff doesn't have to comply. However, we make hundreds of millions of headsets every year. All that lead, it actually ends in a garbage dump and then it leaches into the water supply. So there's a happy medium there somewhere. I think they went a little far because circuit boards are not so reliable anymore. They're not going to last, actually.
Then you got to buy another one.
So there's going to be
the
more
manufacturers
stuff
are
going
happy. It's the
and it'll go. It all ends up in landfill anyway. But at least it's less toxic. So it's a mixed bag. I mean,
what are the European headphone manufacturers, which high end ones you were mentioning, where a lot of them were Germany and stuff. What do they think about these rules?
They like them. They can comply. If you're building a Sennheiser's HD800 is $1,300 US. They can afford whatever they want. There are special solders that are expensive, that are used.
No, I meant it's about the sound pressure level.
Oh.
Yeah.
The sound pressure level thing.
You know, I suspect that this is for mass market MP3 player cellular telephony type things. And so how many
headphones? So it's not portable.
Portable, right. So AKG, Sennheiser, Beyer, Dynamic. Sure. How many headphones do they sell? Maybe all of them together do 100,000 or 200,000? I mean, a production line in one day, the Xbox headset probably does, 50,000 a shift or so, 50,000 a day probably. I mean, that's how many headsets Xbox sells. They're little green and white mono headsets. That line, I'm in the factory at 12:30 at night. That line is still running. So the numbers are so large for consumer products that you can make the case that you have to watch out for toxic stuff. High-end stuff,
AKG, Sennheiser, these guys, they don't sell a lot at that exotic end. The pro market itself, how big is the pro audio market? We live in it, but it's really small.
Let's start.
Last question. Last because it's 10:01. Go ahead.
Okay. At the risk of sidetracking us and starting another long discussion, how good a job does the standard do of actually defining how you decide whether your headphones and earphones are associated with portable audio equipment, and so whether this requirement applies to them? Is it anything that you can potentially plug into an MP3 player? What if someone later makes an adapter whereby I can somehow I can
like quarter
hook
to
up
eight,
my,
for instance.
Yeah. Okay, so we already have adapters.
It's a poorly drafted standard, but they will go at it again. This is relatively recent, so they'll get it again.
Your first one was 2000, this is 2003.
Yes, so every couple of years they'll go back. I suspect they'll only be implemented digitally through USB stuff, and they'll let analog slide. Maybe they'll go after the integrated players. Look, the intention's reasonable, but the way they're getting there, and actually in all the European standards, if you're subjected to reading standards a lot, they're very convoluted. They're meaning well, but this is not a good solution, not practical. Okay. I think that's about it, because it's now 10:02.
Thank you all for coming.
Thanks.
Keep your eyes on our website. You'll find out what's happening. You're probably on our mailing list. And if not, that's why you fill in the blanks.
See, that's what we need, a standard of that kind of exposure to European standards.